One of the most frustrating things in life is the gap between expectation and reality, between what we think is happening and what's really happening, sometimes between our plans and what we manage to achieve. Art lessons in school were perhaps my most frustrating lesson. I'd have a really clear picture in my head of what I wanted to produce, but when it came to getting it down on the paper, well, it wasn't so good. Whether it was a drawing or a painting or anything, well, it never looked anything like the image that I'd had in my head. It always looked like some kind of deformed, half-melted version of what I'd pictured. And that's not just the case in art, is it? That gap between what we think and reality, between expectation and what we experience. The ideal in life is very often different from the reality. That can be true in our relationships. It can be true in friendships. It can be true in our work. What we're promised isn't what turns out. It can be true in the things we buy that hold out so much and fail to deliver on their promises. It's even true of ourselves. We often fail to be the me we want to be, the me we promise. Reality doesn't live up to the image we have in our heads. And one of the problems with that is we get used to being let down. And so because we live daily with this gap between expectation and reality, or even between what's claimed and what happens, we gradually learn not to put our hopes in people or things. That we find ourselves hedging our bets, being careful not to invest too much of ourselves in any relationship or person or friendship. Maybe that's seen in not joining a church or going along but being reluctant to commit. Maybe it's seen in a relationship and not wanting to invest too much of yourself because of previous bad experience or previous hurts. When we've been let down by something or someone, it can be hard to fully trust again. We lower our expectations that we never really trust. Matthew writes to convince first century disciples that they should be sold out for Jesus. He wants followers of Jesus who joyfully give their all and willingly count it a privilege to go to the ends of the earth to make more disciples as they take the good news of Jesus. But he doesn't do so by sending them a motivational letter or by following the advertiser's strategy and painting a bigger, grander vision of how great life following Jesus will be. He does so by showing the first century believers the real Jesus. Jesus, God with us, fully God, fully man, the one true man in whom ideal and real aren't just met, but Jesus who is far greater than we expect, not less. There are two dangers for disciples, two dangers that limit our discipleship, our following of Jesus. One is failing to really see who Jesus is and therefore not fully trusting him. The other is having a deformed view of discipleship, not really seeing what Jesus is calling us to. I wonder which of those are you more prone to as you think about it this morning? Have we entrusted ourselves fully to Jesus? Are we sold out for him? Or are we holding back? Maybe waiting for him to let us down? Or perhaps for some of us, we find ourselves thinking that, well, he has let us down. There's a certain situation, a certain thing we prayed and Jesus hasn't come through. So can I trust him? Maybe another question we need to ask is, do we have a right view of discipleship? Following Jesus as the only way or as one way among many? Are we putting him first? Are we following now or waiting for some mythical day in the future when we will fully seek his kingdom? As we come to Matthew 8 and verses 14 to 22, Matthew wants us to really see Jesus so that we understand why he is worth giving our all to. There's a couple of headings we're going to hang our thoughts on this morning. The first is this, as we look at verses 14 to 17. Jesus is the suffering servant we can fully entrust ourselves to. Verses 14 to 17 show us the third in this trio of miracles and healings. Jesus is at Peter's house, verse 14, and Peter's mother-in-law is lying in bed with a fever. Notice here that unlike the previous two miracles, no one asks Jesus for healing. But notice what Jesus does. Verse 15, he touched her hand and the fever left her and she got up and began to wait on him. Jesus sees her suffering and he is moved to act. He doesn't need to be asked. He sees it and he wants to heal her. He is moved with compassion. And it leads him to heal. He touches her and the fever leaves her. Jesus isn't bound by convention or fear. He touches, he comforts, he wipes away her fever. That in itself, it is amazing. But there's more here. Now this is Jesus' third healing. And think about it, who has he healed so far? A leper, a Gentile centurion, and now a woman. All people his society looked down on. All people they treated as less than others. But not Jesus. Jesus as God knows that everyone is made in the image of God. He was there. He made them equal. He made them in his image, precious to him. And so Jesus heals them all. He has compassion on all. He moves towards all and he welcomes all into his kingdom, whether male or female, Jew or Gentile. There are no classes in God's kingdom. All are made in the image of God and all redeemed to play their part in his kingdom. And notice Peter's mother-in-law does. She's so completely healed that she doesn't need to go to bed for a couple of days with a bottle of Lucozade. She's restored to wholeness right then. It's as if the fever has never been there at all. And she serves them. And then verse 16 carries on with this third little picture of healings and miracles. Later that Sabbath day, when evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him. And he drove out the spirits with a word and healed all who were ill. It's a fascinating picture, isn't it? There is a dusk-lit outdoor hospital ward. And Jesus speaking and healing. And what do we see? We see his sheer power. We see his authority as he rolls back sickness and oppression with just a word restoring wholeness and bringing freedom. And Matthew doesn't want disciples to miss what this means. He doesn't want us to fail to see the significance of this event. Just as the events of Jesus' birth that Matthew records, he helps us see the significance of them with Old Testament prophecy, so he does here. He helps us see the significance of the miracles by shining the light of the Old Testament on them. Look at verse 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and bore our diseases. Turn back to Isaiah 53 in your Bibles. As Matthew quotes verse 4, it's a little like that present that you buy for someone. You open it to check that everything's in there and then you find, well, there's so much that you simply can't get it back in and you wonder how on earth it was all in there in the first place. Well, as Matthew quotes verse 4 of Isaiah 53, he's drawing our attention back to the whole of the chapter. We're just going to read verses 3 to 6 together. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces. He was despised and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him and afflicted. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Isaiah prophesies the coming of God's servant, and that servant will suffer. He'll take our pain, he'll take our suffering on himself. Ultimately, he'll be pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. He'll bear our punishment so we can know peace with God. His wounds will bring us healing and bring back the wanderers. Now, Matthew quotes Isaiah 53:4 here because that's what these miracles are showing. Jesus' miracles are a flashing neon sign pointing us to something, declaring that Jesus is the suffering servant who has come to rescue lost sheep. The miracles declare that Jesus is the one, God's promised one, who has come to bear our sin, to restore us to wholeness. That word peace, that means not a quiet, restful afternoon, not an uneasy truce between two warring parties, but a deep peace where everything is right between us and God, and therefore between us and one another and the world. The miracles, Matthew says, help us see Jesus, that he has come to bring the kingdom, but that he'll do so through suffering, taking on all the brokenness and pain and wrath that results from sin and overcoming it. The miracles, healings, freeings, cleansings are a scale model of his kingdom, showing us the much bigger reality of what his kingdom come will be like and inviting us to come in and enjoy it if we'll have Jesus as our king. It also helps us see back in that Isaiah passage and the connection Matthew makes with the way he quotes it, that our uncleanness, our suffering and disease and oppression are all connected. There aren't multiple underlying causes of these. At root, there is just one cause: sin. Our rejection of God and his word, our denial of his goodness and love, and our stubborn determination to turn away from him are at the root of all of these things. That sin is like the poison at the source of the spring that infects and warps and kills everything that flows from it. And Jesus has come in love to die in our place, to bear our punishment, to overcome it all, to face the justice we deserve and provide forgiveness and peace, the opportunity to be whole again, to know shame and sin paid for, to be children of God as we were made to be, if we'll trust him. These miracles prove that Jesus is God made man, God come to comfort and restore his people, God in love stooping to become one of us, the suffering servant who will go to the cross for us so that we can enjoy his kingdom. Now, as our world groans and moans and grieves the reality of sin made visible in sickness,